Welcome, everyone. This is Mia Ferraletto, publisher of New Observations magazine. Welcome to our show. Today, I have the honor and the fun of doing a two-hour talk with my colleague on Dreamland, Mike Clellan. Hello, Mike.
Hello, thank you.
And interestingly enough, the two of us have similar backgrounds in terms of spiritual and psychic experiences, as well as a background in the art world. So the overlaps are pretty pronounced, and we thought it would be great fun to share our lives with you in this particular way. So welcome to the show. It's an interesting time for all of us to be sequestered and have the opportunity to go within in a much more pronounced way than we do in our daily lives. And hopefully we'll be able to give you a fairly clear overview of our individual lives and how we've come to this place and come to the commitment of doing a show, a weekly show, bringing people together to share ideas and experiences. So here we are. Mike, how is your time being sequestered in the Lake Placid area of New York State? It must be beautiful with spring.
Well, it doesn't seem like spring right now. I think we're about the same latitude. I woke up to snow this morning, which is not at all unusual for April around here, but it's not much. I'm sure it'll melt off before the day is up, but there's an inch or so out the door. You know, it's the town I live in is so far north of New York that there's almost no, I guess there's no issues of being fearful here. The schools are closed and people are being very prudent at the grocery store and such. As far as, you know, the last couple times I went to the grocery store, it was nobody was wearing masks. And this last time everyone was wearing masks. So I get the sense that, you know, everyone recognizes that we're not in the epicenter of it right here. I mean, New York State has the highest number of cases, but that's all related to New York City mostly, which is a long way south from where I am right here. So it's been remarkably calm, and there's no sense of drama or fear associated with this here, which has been rather peaceful. So, you know, my concern is how long this will take to play out and you know, get a little stir crazy in the house and such. But I have a beautiful area just around me. So just going for walks has been easy and lovely. Spring is in the air, except for today. It seems a little more wintry. So it's been just as far as the, you know, what we have needed to do here has been fine. My partner Andrea and I run a small inn here in upstate New York, and that has certainly taken. We've obviously had to close that down completely. We only have a few rooms, and it's mostly during the summer. And April is a time where we do not get many bookings. So it's obviously changed things, but you know, we're taking a hit financially. But there's not too much difference than a traditional April up here. Once summertime comes, that's where we depend on people coming to visit.
Well, I'm in Vermont in a very similar situation to yours. It's very peaceful. People are, you know, calm and complying to the protocols that Governor Phil Scott has put into place. And last night I participated in a phone call with Bernie Sanders and Patrick Leahy and Governor Scott and Congressman Peter Welch and some experts in the unemployment and medical fields within the state of Vermont, and everyone answered questions. It was very well done, and I think people appreciated it a great deal. But for the most part, aside from the fact that, you know, approximately 600 people in Vermont have had the virus and we have had 23 deaths, all of that has kind of stabilized. And looking good in terms of the isolation, the imposed staying at home has kind of curtailed what could have happened. I lived in Manhattan for 18 years, and seeing all the pictures on the New York Times and other websites and speaking to friends who are still living there is difficult. It's so surreal to see the streets of New York completely empty and hearing, you know, the challenges that my friends and associates are dealing with in the city. I'm so grateful to be in such a beautiful, peaceful place.
And I lived in New York City for 10 years, between 1981 and 1991. And it's surreal. And, you know, but there was these times when I would get up really early in the morning on a Sunday and just kind of walk the city in that quiet time. And there's an eerie beauty to that city in those moments of quietness. But I will tell you, even on the quietest Sunday morning, there's still people out in cars driving and such.
Yeah, the city never sleeps.
Exactly, exactly.
Until now. Now it's really shut down. Curious to know, while you were living in New York City, did you have any UFO sightings or extreme psychic experiences?
I had, I certainly had a few curious psychic things, or powerful synchronicities, let's say. And I guess there was one event that happened, this would have been in 1992. I was back for the summer. I was sort of between jobs and I was about to move out west and stuff like that. So I came back and lived with my old, wasn't my college roommate, but an old friend from college in his apartment down in Greenwich Village for the summer. And I just took on some advertising work to try to make some money. But I did have a curious synchronicity that point that certainly had to do with the contact experience, I guess. You want to hear it? I can tell it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it.
So I don't know if I've ever told this online here. I was living on Second Street in the East Village, and I was actually a rock climber. I was doing a lot of rock climbing at the time. I haven't done much in the last few years, but at the time I was very, very dedicated to rock climbing. There's a spot where, very famous spot for rock climbing just north of the city in a town called New Paltz, and it's about a 90-minute drive. And I used to sleep out there a lot at night. There's a spot that I had, and it was off in the woods, and it was at what amounted to the top of the cliff system. Now, it's not like I was like a tiny little cliff I was sleeping on. It was like a huge, beautiful, giant expanse of this wonderful white rock that I would sleep on. And I learned to really like it. In the summertime, I would just go up there with a sleeping bag and a pad, and I would sleep out under the stars. And then the next morning, I would find a partner and meet up with friends and go rock climbing for the day. So there was a point in, I guess it would have been 1993, and I was living at the house or the apartment, and I just felt it all day long. Like, I got to go. I got to get up there. I got to be there. I got to be there. I got to be there. And at about 11:30 at night, which is the only time I've ever done this, at 11:30 at night, I was like, I got to go. I got to go up there and sleep under the stars. And so I got in my car, and this is I think it was a Friday night, which is kind of a zoo in the village. It's a, you know, it's like living in the Mardi Gras every night of the year in a way. So I got in the car and started driving north. It's about a 90-minute drive. And as I was – and there's traffic even late at night, 11:30 at night in New York City. So I was kind of stuck in traffic on the FDR. And I said to myself, like, oh, God, they're really pushing hard tonight. And that came out of my mouth. And I was very well versed with the UFO literature. Like, I'd read a lot. And I had had some stuff in my youth. But I was denying all of it. And when that came out of my mouth, I was like, wow, where did that come from? So I went and slept out under the stars finished the drive. I parked the car. I carried my stuff off into the woods, this simple little trail. I just hiked with a headlamp and slept on this big, flat expanse of rock. Now, it's interesting. The rock is really lumpy, but there's one spot I found, and it was in this beautiful spot, and it was just flat enough in this one spot that I could lay my pad down. So that's about 6 foot by 2 foot. And so I laid the pad down and I slept, and I slept wonderful. Nothing happened that I know of. and then years later, Whitley Strieber put a little thing on his blog, and he mentioned the Mohonk Preserve, where the climbing is. It's a private preserve just outside of New Paltz, New York. And he said, oh, this is very near my cabin. It was probably 2011 or 12 when I read this. And I was like, wait a minute. He had mentioned that he would lived near the town of Accord. And I did a little look and Googling and found out. So anyway, I realized that I was about a mile and a half to 2 miles away from his cabin. And he would have been, I think he was living there in 93. So that was sort of odd to be so close and have that. And then years later, probably in the early 2000s, I went back to the spot and I was climbing there with some friends visiting New York City. I had been living out west in Idaho, and I went back to the spot and I said, I'm going to try to find my sleeping spot. Like I was like, I wonder if I can even find it. So I just walked right to it. I found it right away, instantly. It's exactly the spot. It was an huge expanse of milky white rock, full daylight, and someone had spray painted a pentagram on the spot where I had slept, which I thought was a very odd little detail. So for me, this is how this stuff is welling up. For me, it's welling up with these subtle synchronicities and this very eerie, I guess I don't want to, I almost want to say like low level confirmation. This was well before I had actually believed that these things were possible in my life. I was very much in a state of denial. So that was very troubling for me. All the aspects of that, especially that voice where I said, boy, they are pushing hard tonight, as I was driving north on the FDR.
Yeah, you definitely understood that you were getting a message from elsewhere.
I did not want to understand it, though. I wanted to slam the door shut on that and not deal with it. So that eventually came to a screeching halt, that ability to say, no, it can't be real. So, hey, I just looked at the clock, and this is probably a good time to take our first break. For non-members, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way, and learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We are back on New Observations, and we are going to continue with the conversation that we had just before the break. Here goes.
I remember in my 20s having my natal chart done for the first time, and the astrologer said to me, you're very mediumistic. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not. You know, I don't pick up anything kind of, you know, denial, because the whole idea of being a medium was not anything that I was interested in even thinking about. But of course, my ability to pick up information is one of the main characteristics of who I am at this point. So it's funny. The ideas, the concepts that we have of ourselves, which are proven right or wrong at various stages in our lives.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what Whitley has done with his work and, bringing people together, forming this community of people who are sharing information with each other, is just a huge contribution. And I know you are too, but I'm very grateful to him for this opportunity.
And I am too. And I am also I'll do a little plug here for the site itself. The archives in this site are remarkable. I was listening back when it was called Whitley's World, and he had this little super low-grade CGI spinning globe. I don't know how many people can remember that, but that was right at the dawn of his website and right at the dawn of, like, before the internet era really took off. And I just was, like, astonished that I could get online and listen to these archived interviews back then, right? So, I mean, before it was like you had to set your clock and stay up late to listen to Coast to Coast on the AM radio. You know, there was no way to really record it in any kind of meaningful way. And the volume of powerful interviews in the archives on this site is just remarkable, just remarkable. So that alone for me is worth the whatever the small fee is for the membership here. So I don't want it to sound too much like I'm plugging it, but I am plugging it. So.
Oh, yeah. I think anyone who's listening should become a member to the site and support what Whitley's doing. We're on the brink of so much information coming out into the forefront that's been kept quiet, you know, for eons. And as a resource, this work cannot be beat. It's just so vast and covers, you know, everything from Catherine Austin Fitz and the secret government and all the money that's gone missing to research by Linda Moulton Howe and others. It's just a remarkable resource.
As well as like the first person experience. That's what I'm much more interested in. You know, like I feel like I have very little control over what happens at the grand level of the secret keepers, but I certainly feel like I have a lot of control talking to people one-on-one about their own experiences or listening to a conversation about people with their own experiences. Anne Strieber ran the contactee interviews for a few years here. Actually, I was the very first contactee interview on that show, that series.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that happened because I met and I sat with Anne and talked with her for a while at a conference that was back in 2009 in Joshua Tree, California, at this wonderful, I think it was called the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. It was built by Frank Lloyd Wright, and it just was this amazing center off in the desert, and it was old. I mean, all the buildings there must have been about 60 years old, and they just looked like they were all kind of bleary from 60 years of the desert sun, but it had the coolest vibe to it, that place. Just a remarkable place to run a conference like this. That was one of his Dreamland conferences. And when I spoke with Anne, she got back to me later and said, I want to do a talk with you. And so, yeah, that was the first one.
So what was your first contactee experience? Do you have a specific one that, you know, stands out?
Yeah, well, two things happened in 1974. And I would have been 12 years old. I'm 57 now. So 1974, I would have been a 12-year-old boy living in Southfield, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. Interestingly, my high school was the rival high school to William Henry's high school, which was about a mile away. So I spoke with William Henry a little bit, and we grew up about 2 miles away. Our high schools were both on the same road. They were on Evergreen Road, and they were about a mile apart. So I just thought that was a curious detail.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. So I was at a sleepover at my friend's house when I was 12, and we both drew. I'm an illustrator, and we would draw, and that was part of our friendship that we would draw. And I remember that day we had paper and pencils on the kitchen table and like a little shoebox full of, you know, pens and colored pencils probably. And we were looking out the window, or I can't remember who it was. We were in his room, and I remember we had just walked into the room, and it was dark. Like we hadn't quite flipped the light switch on in his room. It was nighttime on a weekend. And I remember, I don't know if it was him or me, said, well, look, look, look. And out the window, there was this shape. There was this coffee can shaped craft, very clear in the night sky. Like it wasn't like a little dot way off in the distance. This was very clear. We both pushed our noses right up against the glass. So given that, it certainly was not something reflected behind us. You know, we would have obscured it because our faces were right up against the glass. And it was moving in this extremely strange way. The motion itself was like too slow or too controlled. It did not look like a, you know, like a airplane flies, right? There's an engine that pushes it one direction and the wings hold it up in the air and it flies. And a helicopter has a propeller that keeps it aloft. And balloons and things like that have kind of a vibe to them that I could recognize. This was absolutely, I went through the checklist. It's not a plane. It's not a helicopter. It's not a balloon. And I literally remember like the hair kind of standing up on the back of my neck. Like this is alien. This is not, I mean, it's alien in the kind of Webster's definition of, you know, something absolutely unknown. And we watched it for maybe 30 seconds. It was descending at this very eerie way, like at an angle that did not seem like any kind of angle that a plane would fly at or a balloon, or, and then just all of a sudden, click, it was gone. Just boom, vanished. And I never said that. I would always tell the story as a boy. I would say, well, the lights turned off and we could no longer see it. And I knew I was lying when I told that as a little boy afterwards. And it vanished. And I say that now because I've read so many reports of things vanishing. I feel like I have permission to say it, but I did not feel like I had permission as a 12-year-old boy to say something so absurd. I basically said the lights went out, we couldn't see it, but that was a lie. Now that we both ran downstairs. I think I said, let's draw it. Let's not talk about it. Let's draw it. And we ran downstairs and we sat at the kitchen table and we drew it. And I still have my illustration. I remember between the two illustrations, they were close to identical, but I draw it as like a true coffee can shape. And then my friend Kenny, he said, no, there was a little bevel on the edges of the coffee can. You know, at the top and bottom, it was a little 45-degree bevel. And he was right. And you can see on my drawing where I actually kind of erased it and corrected it. And I remember that conversation. So that happened as a 12-year-old boy. And that same year, which was 1974, I was walking home from a high school football game. And I apologize if people have heard this story before, but this was a big deal for me. And it was with a friend. His name was also Mike. And we were walking through the neighborhood. And now, I knew what time we left the football game because I wanted to be home in time to see a television show that was on at 9 o'clock, excuse me, at 10 o'clock on Friday nights. And it was Cole Shack, The Night Stalker. I was a 12-year-old boy. This was the perfect
show. Oh, I love that show. Darren McGavin.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And it's aliens and zombies and vampires. And it was like the predecessor to The X-Files.
Right.
So, you know, like I was not going to miss that show. So we get to the spot in the neighborhood and I could put an X on the right on the sidewalk. I know to the millimeter where it happened. And there was this like weird orange flash in the sky. And it felt like God took a light switch and flipped everything orange on, just click off. So it was just calm night sky in Michigan, click, orange, click, back to the night sky. And it was this weird, rich, like, it wasn't like kind of a subtle orange. It was like the color of a, you know, when the coals in a campfire die down,
mm-hmm.
they have that rich, rich, self-illuminating orange color. It was like the whole sky was like that rich, powerful orange color. And then, goop, gone. And both of us were like, what just happened? And we did the little checklist. We like, was it a lightning? No, it didn't. I've never seen lightning like that. Was it an explosion like off over the horizon? Well, we would have heard a noise. It was totally silent. Was it like, we actually even thought did like a, like wires on a telephone pole, like zap and create a flash, but it didn't match that at all. And then, so we got to my house and I said goodbye to my friend and he walked, his house was where he lived, was a further into the neighborhood. And I walked in the door and my parents were right there waiting for me and they were angry. Like, where have you been? What are you doing out so late? I'm like, it's not late. I told you I'd be home at 9:30. It's 9:30. And they pointed to the television set and the 11 o'clock news was ending, which put it at about 11:30.
Wow.
And it did not make any sense at all to me. This is way before the term missing time had come into the vernacular. And I was just like, don't get mad at me. I didn't do anything wrong. Like, I don't know why it's 11:30. I came home like, and they were mad at me. And they're like, I don't like, it was hard. Like emotionally, my parents were angry at me. And on top of that, I missed this cool TV show that I really wanted to watch. Now, the next Monday in school, my friend Mike, I picture us at the cafeteria. And I remember this conversation. And I said, you know, a bunch of our friends all sitting around, they're 12-year-old boys. And I'm like, you know, something weird happened Friday night when we were walking home from the football game. And my friend Mike said, yeah, we saw a UFO with lights and everything. And I was like,
it's fantastic that in both of your cases, you had a witness, you had a fellow experiencer.
Well, I've gotten in touch with both of them. And Kenny, I don't want to say too much about his private life, but he's suffering from some health issues. And he basically said, you know, like, I can't remember. My health has been terrible and my memory's shot. And then he got back to me and he talked to his mom. And he said, my mom remembers the night we came downstairs and drew it at the kitchen table. She remembers that, but he had no memory at all of it. And then I asked my friend Mike just this last summer, like that was like 40 years later or something. So I asked my friend Mike, did you remember seeing it? And he said, no, I don't have any memory at all of it. But I do remember you got in trouble for coming home late. I do remember that, which is an odd detail because both of those, again, there's this like soft confirmation, right? It's hard to declare what might have happened given their memories, but those are confirming to me that he remembered I was got in trouble and that my other friend, Kenny, his mom remembered we were drawing at the kitchen table, drawing a UFO that we had just seen.
Well, and you still have your drawing.
And I still have the drawing, yeah.
So you have a representation of what you actually saw as well, which is great.
Now here, let's just to tell the story completely, I had always had the two memories of the night in walking home from the football game. I remember I had walked home from the football game and saw an orange flash. And then over the years, it felt like it was a different football game when I came home with the missing time. And somehow I had just kept these two things separate in my mind. I mean, sometime in my late 20s, I started compulsively reading UFO books. And that has continued to this day. So on the very first episode of when I rented the very first episode in VHS at the little gas station, actually, it was at the gas station in my small town. They had a little video rental place and I could rent the very first episode of The X-Files. And at the end, they had a little bonus feature there. And it was like, and now an interview with The X-Files creator, Chris Carter. And he's sitting there in his little director chair. And it's a little stagey thing, but he talks about the genesis of the show. And pretty much the first thing he says is, I wanted to create a show that matched my favorite show as a little kid. And that show was Kolchak the Night Stalker. And when he said that, like these two memories just like, bam, cemented together. And I realized like, oh my word, that was the same night. That was the same night. The missing time and the orange flash in the sky. My friend Mike said he saw a UFO, but all I remember is an orange flash in the sky. That was the same night. And it scared me. This would have probably been in about 1997 or something like that. And it scared me. And I remember walking around my little cabin in Idaho like a caged wild animal. Like I was just pacing the house. It scared me to have those two memories come together. And in the intervening years, there have been so many powerful synchronicities related to me trying to uncover that story and tell that story that I have to trust that the orange flash and the missing time happened the very same night, though I didn't fit those two puzzle pieces together until around 1997 or so.
So in going back to that time or the ensuing years, you had an association of fear in terms of reviewing this or a reluctance to review this?
Not so much fear. I mean, yes, the fear would have been like fear of being made fun of or something like that. So
uh-huh.
And I've had some scary experiences, not many, one in particular, but so it was more just denial. Like I did not want to go there.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading UFO literature. Like I knew exactly what it meant. Like I read Communion. I'd read all about Hopkins books. I knew just what it meant to be, you know, I knew what a UFO abductee was, what it was supposed to be given what I had read. And I did not want to put myself in that category. I was saying, like I knew the implications of the missing time and the sighting, and I did not want to treat it literally. So,
yeah, well, the early 90s, 30 years ago, things were very different at that time. And I remember when I first started talking about UFOs and ETs and visitations and all of that, the people around me were scared. I mean, I was not scared. Because for me, the experiences had been extremely positive, but the people around me were concerned that, you know, I was losing it in some way. But, you know, my background is one of you know, countless mystical experiences from the time I was a very small child, and pronounced psychic abilities, knowing what was going to happen in advance. And I would say to my parents, oh, Aunt so-and-so is going to do such and such, like a week before it would happen, or we'd watch a news story and I'd say, you know, the outcome is going to be blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, you know, within a week or 10 days, whatever came out of me would have transpired. And I had an amazing ability from the time I was very small to manifest things, to, you know, have a thought and bring it into reality, or manifest of something physical, which has been a lifelong characteristic of things that have happened around me.
Oh, I would love to hear some examples. But first, I think we should take our second break. For free listeners, you will hear some commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff, Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like, and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as a Kindle, as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and as also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on Audible.com.
We are back on New Observations. And just before the break, I was about to ask Mia for a few examples, so I'll do that now. Mia, I would love to hear some examples of what you were talking about before, these experiences.
Well, freshman year of college, we were standing in line for the lottery to register, and I said, I want number one, because, you know, I would be the first person then to be able to choose my classes. And I pulled my number one right out of the, you know, box of numbers of over, I don't know, about 250 students. I can be in a store, for instance. And one day I was in a gift shop and I was admiring, you know, the yellow rubber duckies that lots of people have floating in their bathtubs. And there was a larger one, and it just made me smile. And later on that day, I was at another store, maybe a half an hour away, and I came out from the store, and sitting by the driver's side door was a yellow rubber ducky just waiting there for me. My favorite story is my diamond earring story. This one particular week, I was selling my house in upstate New York, and throughout the week, I had seen three different women wearing different size bezel set diamond earrings. And the woman with the largest diamonds was married to a doctor. They had come and were looking at my house to possibly purchase. And I jokingly said to my realtor, I need a doctor husband so I can have bezel set diamond earrings. And a few days later, I was cleaning my closet, and the people I had bought my house from, the husband was an architect, and he had built this shoe rack all around the interior of the master closet. And I was lifting the shelves and cleaning underneath, and there was a little shriveled dead mouse, some dust bunnies, and a jewelry box lying there under the shelf. And I opened the box, and there were bezel set diamond earrings in the box. But what was so interesting is that each earring had three different sized bezel set diamonds, all similar to what I had seen the week before, different women wearing. So I got my diamond earrings, and I had them broken down into three different pairs, and I gave them all away as gifts. So these are just some examples. I had a massive limb on my property that blocked the view to the pond, and I was thinking of having that limb removed. I woke up the next morning and the limb was lying on the ground.
And this is just a thought. You never spoke it aloud.
Well, I have done the speaking aloud thing too. I went through a whole phase where I learned, first of all, I saw the energy come off the page from the words that I had written. I actually saw the energy come up into the ethers. But I learned, living with my six dogs, I lived with a pack of six large dogs, all rescues, for many years. Most of them lived to be 14. And one particular day, they were digging in the dirt and eating worms. And I jokingly said aloud, my dogs are eating worms. And the next day, I opened a brand new bag of 40-pound bag of dog food, and it was full of worms. And then I started to really focus on the spoken word and the power of the spoken word, but quite literally just a fleeting thought. I mean, that's the interesting thing to me, that, you know, part of what I want to do is share my experiences in a simple way, because it actually is very simple, so that people can learn to, you know, develop these things within themselves. If there's one mission that I have, it would be that. And I think in general, people make things far more complicated than they need to be. It's actually pretty simple. You just need a clear expression, clear thought, clear intention. So,
And this is just the stories you're telling are exactly the kind of thing I find that I'm drawn to in my research. These kind of very subtle, outlying, synchronistic or I almost, you know, magical events that to me imply so much. I think these happen to a lot of people often, and they're wary to trust them. And I think by denying them, I think they get shut down sometimes. And then by cultivating them, which I feel like I've done with synchronicity to some degree, like really powerful magical events can unfold.
Oh, on a huge scale. I mean, I was meditating one day on Jesus healing the blind and putting it out to the universe, as I often broadcast energy. And the next day I turned on my computer, and the very first story that came up was of a blind man in New Jersey who was spontaneously healed. I think this is who we really are. This is our birthright. These are all aspects of our spiritual and divine nature. And because I was born this way and, you know, communicated with animals from the time I was a very small child, just had access to other realms. My mother taught school the day she had me and went back to teaching school 2 weeks later because she was the main source of support for our family. My father was in medical school up at UVM. So I was alone. You know, I didn't have parents around me for the majority of each and every day. And I truly connected psychically to other realms from that time. And I do believe that I came in that way. But then at 19, I was tested at Columbia University for right and left brain hemisphere activity. And I was told that out of anyone they tested, my brain was the most balanced. And I do process information on both sides of my brain at the same time. So I think because of that, I walk this middle path. And, you know, these synchronicities and many other things are so integrated in my daily life that I just move, you know, in and out of these spaces, these conscious and unconscious spaces all the time.
This is fascinating. Yeah. I mean, this is these more subtle events that, I mean, I'm almost at a point now where I mean, I'm writing books about UFOs and I don't really care about the UFO part, right? Like, I don't really care about the sighting itself. I mean, obviously I do, but that has been covered a lot in other people's work. And there's this other stuff that's going on, let's say below the waterline or I don't want to be hypnotized by the UFO to the detriment of ignoring these very subtle and oftentimes very beautiful experiences that can take place in the shadow of the UFO, if that makes sense.
Well, the UFO piece of it for me is just one small part of it. The angelic realm, the animal realm, the devic realm, the mineral, these are all worlds that we're interacting with and working with, you know, every day, every minute. And the UFOs and the ET piece of it is just one part of it.
Oh, that's interesting. The way I frame it is that, like, you know, the story, the UFO story will only take you so far. Like, to really get drawn into the story, it's these subtler plot points that just slay me, that I'm really drawn to them, and that's what I've been archiving. So yes, I mean, obviously I've got my own issues with owls, you know, just being completely dragged down that corridor. But the story itself, and oftentimes a story is like a parable, right? It doesn't have to be punctuated with a conclusion the way a detective novel is. But you can certainly, on a subconscious level, glean so much from an experience or a long list of experiences that people have endured or gone through, or, you know, have helped transform them in some way. And that's what I'm certainly tied very much into the natural world and very much into the realm of birds, especially owls and totem animals and things like that, and mythology. But the only way that feels appropriate to tell all that is to tell it through story.
Well, there's a long tradition of that, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Man is a storyteller, so it makes sense that you would go that route.
I use the term campfire story a lot because that's a perfect analogy in a way, because in a campfire story doesn't have to have a punchline the way a novel does. You know, a campfire story doesn't need to make sense. A novel does need to make sense.
Right.
And I worry that the nuts and bolts half of the research community is trying to make sense of this with a tidy conclusion, with a summation, with an answer. And I feel like we're never going to get that true answer. We're always going to be confronted with more and more questions. And I just think that's the reality of where we are in this 3D realm. Some people can access other realms, but it's fleeting. And oftentimes if someone says they have an answer, boy, I'm very shy to trust what they say, because the next person also has an answer and it's completely different.
Well, my sense is this virus is going to help people connect to inner dimensions within themselves. And I believe that that's a very big part of why all of this is happening. And the heart-centered link to each other and the way compassion is spreading as a result of this is making a big difference. We experienced this after 9/11 until the 1st of 2002. Americans were very heart-centered at that time and thinking of others, but we were not able to sustain it moving into the new year. It all kind of dissipated after that. But this is much more up close and personal because every state is participating in this. And
every place in the world, too.
Exactly. Exactly. But we're, you know, our country specifically is fairly materialistic, you know, to the extreme, I would say. And that has to change. We're, you know, 3D materialism is fine, but we are spiritual beings living a physical experience, which is very different.
Oh, well, time will tell. I mean, this is going to be archived, and, you know, who knows how this will sound, you know, listening to it a year later or a few years later. But, you know, I hope that we can rise above the pettiness that sort of defines so much of the American experience in a way, or, you know, that's what I see so much in the modern American experience, and, you know, the divisiveness of the elections. It's gotten so ugly. And so my hope is somehow that ugliness, I would love it to disappear completely, but I would certainly hope it tones down a lot after this. And we may be confronted as a global community with a brutal chapter of economic depression. And that is going to be a challenge. But we've overcome all kinds of challenges as people throughout our time on this globe.
Well, having lived through phases of my life where I've had unlimited checking and then phases of my life where I've counted every nickel, I can say for certain that the universe provides. Never once have I been without what I've needed at any given moment in time. And as Kierkegaard, you know, said, God takes care of the birds of the air. You know, why would that not be true for us? And that's a huge lesson that we all have to open ourselves up to, because it's a universal truth. Abundance is there for everyone. We have participated in hoarding for far too long, and we have to change the way we look at things. For the past several years, I've been living off of my Social Security. I took my Social Security early, and it has been the most freeing experience of my life. My basic bills are covered. I publish New Observations magazine. I organize conferences. I'm opening an artist in residency program. I do the work that I love to do and don't worry about getting a paycheck from it. Just continue doing it no matter what. And it's completely transformed the way I do everything and provided an enormous amount of freedom in terms of personal self-expression.
Yeah, and I have certainly lived this out-of-the-box lifestyle where, you know, I was teaching mountain skills. I was teaching backpacking and mountaineering and skiing and stuff like that and out west for 25 years. And, I mean, there's such low pay in that. It's laughable. And I was also doing some illustration work, but I was, oh, my God, I lived this glorious life outdoors and in a beautiful spot. And so I feel so blessed that I you know, I mean, the term is a ski bum, right? I lived the ski bum experience for 25 years. It was a joy.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, with people like Andrew Yang and his universal basic income and other ideas that we're exploring right now, I think a lot will change about our daily financial support. And it already is. And interestingly enough, what I see happening is because of the rise in consciousness, the world has become much more open to this and, you know, taking care of each other, supporting help to those who need it is happening more and more with the virus. in a way that perhaps 20 years ago would not have been the case.
I'd be hard to know. I mean, so what's happened now and 20 years ago, this virus would have been a lot worse without the social networking, without this tool. I mean, you and I are talking over this tool, the internet. That tool didn't exist in any meaningful way 20 years ago. And just getting the word out, you know, basically everyone on the, not everyone on the planet, but a great majority of the planet has chosen just, I'm going to stay indoors to some degree because it'll benefit my fellow humans. We have a template in place, which is the events of 1919 or 1918, I guess, and the pandemic then, which I did a little math the other day, that killed between 2 and 3% of the population of the planet. We're not going to see anything to that degree with this issue now. I mean, it's going to be a bump for sure, but it's a very small bump in the road compared to what happened 102 years ago. And it's heartening to me that everyone just kind of understood that our fellow man is dependent on us not to spread this disease around. And we have chosen collectively without too much difficulty to, you know, stay indoors. I don't think that it's all this stuff about the crushing police state that's going to come out of this. I think that's fear mongering. I think this has been a neighborly thing that it seems like the world is doing.
I agree.
Yeah. And we're all going to take a hit financially. And I mean, I'm certain there are people out there scared and unemployed and that have lost their job and are, and I recognize that there's hardship intertwined with this. But hopefully, collectively, as a country, as a planet, we can, you know, lift our neighbors up.
That opportunity is there, for sure. And that's extraordinary.
Yes, and there's also the opportunity where it could just, you know, flip-flop and the worst part of human nature could arise from it. But I just need to be optimistic. It's in my bones. I wouldn't be able to face myself in the mirror if I wasn't optimistic. And I don't want to say unrealistically optimistic, but I mean, I think that optimism hopefully is infectious. And I know other people out there feel it too.
Oh yeah, I definitely am optimistic about the outcome of all of this. I think spiritual people have been preparing for this day for decades, you know, knowing something was going to come. I don't think a virus was a thing that we were anticipating, but nevertheless, we've been surprised with a virus. And I think that it's a great opportunity for all of us to move into another place, a better place, a more positive place for everyone on the planet.
Agreed. Agreed.
So... my first UFO experience was groundbreaking for me and also what I would consider to be extremely positive. It connected me or made me realize my connection to all of the universe in a very specific way. I had driven from Columbia County, New York, near Albany, over to Needham, Massachusetts, to spend the day with a psychiatrist and ophthalmologist named Lee Sinella, who died in his mid-90s, but he was a Kundalini master and did extraordinary research as a psychiatrist for people who were having spontaneous Kundalini experiences and introducing them to meditation had a very beneficial impact on their spiritual development. And we had become friends and correspondents, and he lived in California, but was visiting his sister in Needham, Massachusetts. And I drove over to spend the day with him and had one of the most profound conversations of my life at the time. This was in 1999, and we spent the day talking about free energy, and his group of friends. We got to know all of the key movers and shakers in the New Age movement in the 1960s, Robert Monroe with the Monroe Institute, Peter and Eileen Cady with Findhorn, Russell Targ with remote viewing, Ingo Swann, again, remote viewing, just all kinds of people. And I had never had that kind of a conversation with someone who was so advanced spiritually and so grounded in terms of psychiatric medicine. And interestingly enough, when I finished graduate school, my first job in New York was, I was the administrator for the third year clerkship in psychiatry at NYU Medical Center, and my office was in the old Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital. When Mark David Chapman killed John Lennon, he was right down the hall from my office in the forensic ward. And I also was the administrator for the first year behavioral science course, which introduced medical students in 1979 to the holistic implications of healing. That was the first time that Western medicine had really started to take a look at all of these other aspects of health and wellness versus illness. So I went to psychiatric grand rounds every week, and my boss was the associate dean of NYU Medical Center, Viva Zimmerman, and a psychiatrist. And we used to talk extensively about psychic abilities, and she shared with me information on the research that Duke University was doing in these areas. So I always was looking both philosophically and from the standpoint of religion, reading extensively, and also reading extensively in the areas of psychiatry and psychology, which really helped to ground me as I experienced my own events in my daily life that many people would perhaps, you know, not be able to handle quite so well. But I left Lee this particular day, and after having had a conversation with him about free energy, I decided, driving back for several hours to my home, that I would experiment on bringing energy in through my crown chakra and running my car on my own energy versus fuel. And I did get home on half the amount of gas that I used to get to Needham. And that night, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and was just lying in bed looking out the window when this massive close encounter ship just silently glided by my bedroom window. And there were gaseous vapors in front of it and behind it, and it was completely soundless. And there were lights coming from inside. And it just moved from left to right. And the next day, I had black army helicopters flying over my house. I called Lee and I told him what had happened. And his response was to say, "Don't make yourself too attractive to them."
And I mean, you asked for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I did ask for it. But for me, what happened was I was filled with such a sense of universal love and interconnectedness. My friends, even when I called to tell them about this experience, told me they could feel the love coming through the phone line. There was just such a beautiful, overwhelming feeling of we are all connected that it was transformative in that way for me. And I'd had lots of visitations from the angelic realm, you know, throughout my life, but this was the first conscious ET experience that I had.
And did it have the same flavor as the angelic experiences?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, well, I think we're all frequency specific, so I mean, I can't imagine, for instance, ever being abducted. That I just don't see that happening to me.
Well, I've got some, yeah, so I'll tell the story in the next one, but I've had some scary stories. I've had one scary event. Oh my God, and that one is even interwoven with this, you know, mystical aspect of it. It just, it plays out like a fable in a lot of ways. So you know, so I have not had the sort of universal love experience, but I've talked to a lot of people who have, and I trust them. So in a way, I would love it, but I don't need it in the sense that, I trust the stories people are sharing.
Right. I think everybody's, well, I think each of our lives is an individual kind of version of Slumdog Millionaire. If you have seen the movie, you know this young guy is on a game show trying to win $1 million, and there are these seemingly random questions, but each one of them has to do with some specific horrific experience, or mostly horrific experiences that happened in his life, and he gets the right answer all the time and becomes a winner. And I personally feel that that's what our lives are at the end of the day. You know, the highs and the lows are providing this the thread as we weave together this lifetime that we're here for, which is really about learning and growing. And we're tying what could seem to be random events are all tied together in some way.
Agreed. Hey, we are just at about the hour mark, a little bit over an hour. We've been talking, and this seems like a perfect spot to end part one, and then we can jump to part two, which will be on my series, and then people can tune into this 2 days from now on Wednesday. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Good. Thank you so much. This has been a delight, and we can jump right into part two.
Absolutely. Great.
Great.
Thank you so much.